Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
And now we are at the interview part of the show. Today we have an author on, and a true crime story. The book is called Luggage by Kroger, a true crime memoir. And the author is with us, Gary Taylor. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Gary, let's quite the story. Let's tell the audience, how did you get involved in this story and get to know all the details?
Well, the story of the book, it's recounts a year in my life back in 1979-80. When I was the courthouse reporter for the Houston Post, and I began a romantic relationship with a local femme fatale lawyer named Catherine Mahaffey. And it evolved from there, and it was quite an adventure. And it took place in the backdrop of the divorce from my second wife, and ended with me getting shot in the head and in the back by Catherine about 3 or 4 months after we began our affair. And over the years, it's catapulted me into a position as the poster boy for true life fatal attraction type stories. I've been on Oprah Winfrey and been on TV shows in that regard. And that's basically the summary of the book. It's told from the first person point of view, and it's essentially a memoir, but the spine of the book is this true crime story about my fatalistic year as the erstwhile boyfriend of this lawyer named Catherine Mahaffey, who's been investigated in a number of cases here in Texas over the years, and the only conviction that's ever occurred against her was in my case for attempted murder.
Wow! So when I was reading this, you were the outline of it. You were the boyfriend that was shot. Okay. So you were a Houston Post reporter. Was that at the time that you knew her, or was that after?
No, that's how we met. Actually, she was First, the story actually is kind of a Basic Instinct type story, only instead of being a cop like Michael Douglas, I was a newspaper reporter. And I was the courthouse reporter there in the late 70s for the Houston Post. And at the time, she was a lawyer working in the courthouse, but she was already under investigation for a murder that had occurred in January of 1979 of her former lover, who she was claiming at the time had been a common law husband. And she was under investigation for that, and she was trying to get his estate. He was a Houston anesthesiologist who was from Argentina, and his name was George Tedesco, and she had gotten involved with him a couple of years before and moved in with him. And, you know, back in those days, it was one of those like palimony kind of things, which was kind of a new phenomenon in love affairs. And he was beaten to death in January of 1979 in his garage. That murder case is still unsolved. And at the time I met her about 6 months later, I was well aware of her because my job as a courthouse reporter was to be aware of pending criminal cases that might come into the courts. And there had been some newspaper articles about Catherine being the lead suspect in this murder that they never could pin on her. And at the time, I was estranged from my second wife and going through this estrangement. I was sleeping on a buddy's couch, and I was still going to the courthouse every day looking for cases. And I happened to meet her at a cocktail party thrown by a lawyer where she was his date. And we struck up an acquaintance. I was walked up to the bar. We were both getting a drink about the same time. And I just looked at her and I said, "So this is the notorious Catherine Mahaffey." And she sort of gave me this sly grin and asked me who I was. When I told her I was a newspaper reporter, she went into a tirade about how she hated the Houston Post because they'd done this story on her, and she had nothing to do with the murder of her, of what she was calling him, her husband. That's how we first met. So she was kind of a side effect to my job, you might say.
Hmm. But that didn't kind of worry you to get involved with her, with that kind of a history? And, you know, I mean, does that put you on edge, sort of, like, to actually date her, you know?
Yeah, I'm not really the kind of guy to run from a trouble like that. She was actually, it actually sort of intrigued me, the mystery of it. And I thought I was fairly safe because, number one, I really didn't have the kind of money background that she seemed like the type that she would go after. And basically, we just talked for a while. We hit it off well. There were reasons I was interested in her, of course, mainly for the physical relationship. And I just have a lot of confidence in myself, and I figure I can get out of problems I have all my life. Plus, as a newspaper reporter, I'd grown accustomed to being acquaintances with all kinds of people, politicians, prison inmates, you know, everything, and this was just another chance to kind of look at that seamier side of life. I really didn't know, you know, what it would lead to, and I thought I could probably disengage when the time came if I needed to do that. It actually gave me kind of an advantage in dealing with her because in a lot of other of her relationships, and she's well known for having volatile relationships, other men in her life sort of stumble across her and aren't sure what they're getting into, I was able to sort of back off and look at everything she said with a grain of salt and sort of take my my chances and try to keep some balance about it. And it worked out to a certain extent, although, you know, I did end up getting shot eventually. So I don't guess it worked out perfectly, but luck was on my side, and that's basically what happened. And our relationship lasted only 3 or 4 months before it floundered on the rocks of violence.
What was that 3 or 4 months like? Was it fairly normal as in a dating situation, and did you find that what you guys did together, like went to a movie or went for dinner, hung out and all that, was everything kind of normal, or was it kind of a weird dating situation?
Well, I described the first 3 weeks of it as a sort of a civilized period. As far as being normal, you got to remember this is the 1970s. When I sign my books, I sometimes write, I blame it all on the 70s. But basically, like I said, I was living on the couch of a friend, one of my editors. So, and she was actually renting a bedroom from a friend of hers who was a male. And we basically just hung out at nights going to bars. She was basically a drinking buddy with benefits. And she was not, like I've said before, she was a lot of fun when she wasn't trying to kill me. She was a well-educated lawyer. She was well-read. She was very witty, funny, a lot of fun to be around. We could go out drinking, and I was in this state where I was sort of trying to get through my, I had just separated from my second wife, had two children, and so I was kind of in a limbo-like state anyway, and that part of our relationship was sort of touch and go. I can remember, there was, quite a bit of sex. This was, like I said, the 70s, and there was no holding back on anything. So we had that going for us, and it was a fairly exciting thing for me. I found out later, she did have some reasons for being attracted to me that were beyond any physical relationship that we might have had. For one thing, she's viewed me as in my reporter capacity. She knew that I spent my days at the courthouse, and I was dealing with lots of people. And I think she admitted this later, that she saw me as kind of a buffer for the investigators that were trying to track her down on this murder case, which she continually told me she had nothing to do with it. And she talked about it incessantly. So it was always interesting there. And, she also later on, very early in the relationship, she tried to talk me into helping her get appointments as, for defending indigents, because she was having trouble getting appointed to cases and making money off of it. And she offered me a deal where she would give me a percentage of any money she got from the county for defending indigent cases where I had helped her secure the appointment. And I told her I couldn't do anything like that. I wasn't, that was not in the books. But she kept thinking that I would give in to that. And then the more she got involved in my life, she realized that I did own a house which was up for sale, so I had a little money. Of course, I was going to be split with my ex-wife whenever we got divorced. But she continually saw angles that I thought for her would be too low rent for her. But as she told me later on, any amount of money is everything she wants to get from me. So it wouldn't matter. When I saw how there did come a point where I saw that she was really more trouble than I could handle, that I was basically playing with fire, I sought to end the relationship. And from that period on out, there was about a 2-month period of where there was endless stalking and the kind of thing that you got to remember, this is late 1979. The term stalking really wasn't even in vogue. In fact, the first time I heard it was when I talked with one of the prosecutors who'd been investigating her, and he told me that we believe she stalked Tedesco before he was murdered. And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, stalking, that's a pretty good term for it, because she would pop up everywhere. She popped up at one of my divorce hearings and started yelling from the back of the room. She went to have a meeting with one of my my managing editor at the Post, and made a lot of allegations about how I was secretly working for the police and trying to uncover her while I was pretending to be a reporter. That led to a fairly funny episode where I was sitting in the courthouse press room, and I got a call from a friend of mine in the Houston Post newsroom. And the way the newsroom was set up, there were all these glass walls where you could see into people's offices. And I picked up the phone, and my friend Ed John said, "Hey Taylor, your psycho girlfriend is over here right now in Kirk Logan's office." Logan happened to be our managing editor, and then Ed talked me through a visualization of everything that was going on. He would say, "And now she's pointing at him, and he's looking at her like he knows there are pornographic movies, but he's never been to one, and he's trying to figure out what it is." And then he said, "Oh, she's leaving now. She's coming out the door. Wait, she's stopping. She's yelling at him again, and she's leaving." And then right after Ed hung up, I got a call from Kirk Logan, and he said he wanted me to get over to the Post right now. You know, back then I strictly worked at the courthouse. I had an office there, and I never went to the Post except to get my check. And he told me, he said, "I want you to drop what you're doing and just get in your car and come to the building." So I got to the building, and he told me I was not going back to the courthouse, that my days on that beat were over. And I said, "Well, you know, I really like that beat. Don't let her take that, you know, don't believe anything she said." And he said, "I don't believe anything she said, but I think you're in severe, serious danger, and I don't want you anywhere that she can come near you again." So, you know, that's how I ended my days on the courthouse beat. But eventually it ended up with her staging a burglary of the place. I was at this point renting a room from somebody else. I'd moved off my editor's couch and into a rental agreement with another friend, and burglars showed up there one night and cleaned us out. And I called her and accused her of doing it. And a couple of days later, after some negotiation, she agreed that she could return some of our stuff if I would come to her duplex where she was living. So I went over to her duplex, and I knew that this was probably going to be the showdown. She explained to me some other things, that she thought I might have other information on her because she was being investigated by the IRS. She was being investigated by the State Bar of Texas, and she just didn't want me around because I had gotten too intricately involved in her business. And I had my buddy, he followed me over there and sat outside her duplex in his car with a shotgun. He was supposed to be back up. He'd also called the district attorney's office to tell him I was over there. So, you know, everybody had been telling me for weeks that I was probably a marked man. I know one of the investigators in town had made a bet with me at a Christmas party. He told me that he bet me $100 that I wouldn't live to attend the 1980 Christmas party, and I took the bet. I took the bet, and everywhere I went, people told me that one of the other reporters told me that the next time he saw me, he expected I'd be wearing a toe tag. So everybody was expecting this, and I basically, from my point of view, she had tormented me to a point where I just wanted to get something over with, and I thought, I'll go over there, see what she does, give her a chance, and she managed to navigate me into a closet, telling me that some things were in there, and I realized I didn't expect to see anything in the closet. We sat around drinking for a while, having this really bizarre evening where she read to me from The Godfather. She wanted to know, she wanted to speak philosophically about love and loss and things like that. And I just sort of played her game. And then once I got in the closet, the lights went out and I heard a pistol cock. And I realized I was trapped in a closet in her back bedroom and that she was coming to do whatever she was going to do. And that's where the confrontation occurred.
So what did she just shot you in the back? So was her intention to kill you, you think?
Well, her intention was that she walked into the bedroom and I was in the closet. As soon as I heard the gun cock, I realized that that I was in pretty serious jeopardy. And I looked around and I thought, boy, what a fool. Here I am. I trapped myself.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Help in this closet. So she stepped into the bedroom, and I had the door between me and her, and I could see out through the crack in the door jamb. And she took the policeman's position there, back against the wall on the other side of the room, and pointed the gun at me and said that I'm going to kill you now, and there's nothing you can do about it. So why don't you just come on out of the closet and take it? And so I started thinking, there's got to be something I can do here. And as luck would have it, there was a wooden chair sitting beside the closet. And I had, actually, she had had me bring that wooden chair down from her attic a couple of months before. So I knew the chair was there, and I could see it out the corner of the door. I started formulating a plan and decided I was going to fight my way out of there using the chair for a shield. So she just continued to rage and rant and tell me how what a miserable miserable person I'd been. Finally, when she like took a breath and I saw her, I could see through the door jamb that her eyes sort of went down. I kicked the door open and I picked up the chair and I came at her kind of like a lion tamer. And she fired off one shot. She was using a .32. She fired off one shot. It went through the chair, hit me in the side of the head, the left side of the head. They found a bullet later on the bed. You know, kind of proof that my head must be pretty hard. And I threw the chair at her, and then I went running down the hallway to the front door, and I saw where she had deadbolted the front door. It was one of those internal latches, and I remember making a note in my head that I would only get one chance to unlock that door. So I stopped and unlocked the door, got it open. And that's when I got shot in the back and was blown through the door out into her front yard. And the bullet later learned it stopped a centimeter from my heart. But when I got, I was laying on the ground out there, and I could hear her coming out onto the porch. This was about 2 a.m. in a little area of downtown Houston, sort of a bohemian area that had a lot of single family homes. Lights were going on all over the neighborhood because the gunshots. And I wondered and I thought, boy, that bitch just shot me. She really did shoot me. And I started to wiggle my toes and wiggle my fingers. And I thought, well, I'm not paralyzed. I better get up and run. So I jumped up and started running. Found out later that she pulled another gun out of a dresser drawer and chased me down the street with that. And I made it to an all-night grocery store and was taken to the hospital. And there at the hospital, I got a call from, when I got in the ambulance, I told the ambulance driver I'd been shot by a woman named Catherine Mahaffey because I didn't know if I was dying or what. And they took me to the hospital. And by then, the homicide detective who I had known, a guy named John Donovan, was the homicide detective who was called to the scene of the shooting. And he called me, and I was in the hospital laying on the gurney. And he actually started laughing. He said, "Taylor, I got to tell you, this scene over here looks like something out of a Roadrunner cartoon. There's holes in the wall." And I said, like in no mood for laughter at that point. And I said, yeah, it must have been quite a show, huh? And he said, "But tell me, which gun did you have?" And I said, "I didn't have a gun." And he said, "Well, she's over here telling me that one of these guns was yours and that she shot you in self-defense." So I said, "Well, I'm shot in the back, John. I mean," and she said, yeah, we're arresting her now, but I just wanted you to know, I don't think it's over." And it wasn't. You know, we ended up with quite a court case that went for 2 trials. And that's why in my book, you know, it's a sort of a conglomeration of everything from a psychological thriller to a courtroom procedural and a police procedural and a serial killer type of thing. There's all kinds of elements there. And It was quite an adventure. Well, yeah, it is kind of a strange name. Back then, when I met her, like I said, I was sort of in one of those periods that anybody who's going through a divorce, a lot of people have been through it. I was keeping my dirty laundry in a paper grocery sack, and I used to call that bag luggage my luggage by Kroger. And the first time we went out, she called me, and we got together to go down to Galveston, because I had a beach house down there, I was going to collect the rent on the beach house, and I asked her if she wanted to drive along. So I drove over to her house to get her. We ended up going in her car, but I told her I wanted to get my luggage by Kroger out from my trunk in case somebody wanted to steal my dirty clothes. So she thought that was quite a hoot that I was running around town with my clothes in a paper grocery sack. And I've always thought that was kind of a metaphor for that period of my life. She was part of my luggage by Kroger. You know, she was something that popped out of that bag as well. And the title for that book, I hemmed and hawed about what to title it. One of my newspaper friends told me that title was unfortunate. I've had other reviewers say they thought it was really cool once they got into the story and once I told my story about what life was like at that time and all of that. But the other title that I thought about was The Widow Wore Red, which was her favorite color. And when I met her, she was a widow wearing red, which would have been probably would have been more commercial title. But when I wrote this book, which I didn't write until 2009, I was less interested in the commercial aspects than I was in the process of actually just recording this story for posterity and for my descendants to have an accurate accounting of what happened to me back in 1979 and 1980. In the meantime, since then, she had gone on to other investigations and had become such a figure that I'd actually gotten a movie deal in 2004 for rights to my story. This was previous to writing the book, and I'd gotten money for that. It actually was produced, and it starred Melanie Griffith as her, as a character based on her, and it starred Isai Morales as a character based on me. It didn't get a lot of wide play. The title of the movie was Heartless, but I did get my $65,000 for rights to that story. And after that came out, I had some people say, you know, you ought to write this down. And I decided that I could do it, but I didn't want it to make it some sort of a whiny memoir. I tried to channel like a Mickey Spillane type of character, telling it in the first person and keeping a bit of humor about it, because in some ways it is a humorous story, although to some of the people affected by her later on after she came off probation, in my case, it's not too humorous. But, if I'd have been paralyzed, it probably wouldn't be very funny either. But there's quite a bit of, I try to get quite a bit of humor in the book as well, and not be one of these pitiful victims, which I've never fancied myself as a classic victim. I realize that I bought into this going into it. I knew what I was getting into basically, and knew I was playing with fire, and I got burned, and I realized that. Also a hell of a story, so I was interested in telling that as well.
Have you talked with her since the book came out, or even the movie, and have you had any interactions, and what's any feedback from her?
No interactions with her since August of 1980, which was about 6 months after the shooting and 3 months after her conviction in my case, where she sought me out in a bar and asked me to, said she was going to appeal the case and she wanted me to drop the charges, et cetera. Now, when I appeared on Oprah Winfrey in 1987, after Fatal Attraction came out as a movie, and at the time I was freelancing and I was the backup for the Time magazine correspondent in Houston. And so the People magazine was doing a story on true life Fatal Attractions. They knew my background, my story, so I became one of the people profiled in that story. Right after that, I started getting all these requests to go on TV, and this was in the late 80s, and Oprah Winfrey was one of them. They tell me that they contacted her at the time. She was still on probation in my case, and so she did not go on the show. I was on the show by myself, and I was never on a show with her. 48 Hours got her on a show on a show about her later in 2003, and I was on that show, and we weren't together on it. But it's kind of funny because when the book came out, I noticed I noticed that one of the Amazon reviews, I read it, and I thought the review was simple, and it was an anonymous review, and it said simply, "This book is so bad, I hope Catherine gets another shot at him." And immediately, when I read that, I knew she's read the book because I'm convinced that was her review.
Well, there you go. Now you know.
But nothing else. Nothing else. No, she's lived back in Houston now and still lives in Houston. And I've never had any contact with her at all.
Wow. What are you hoping that people get out of your book? Like when they pick up the book and read it, what is it that you want them to take away with it?
Well, I think for one thing, it's an intricate study of a stalking case. Usually a lot of the times you've got most true crime books, the victim is dead. So they're unable to tell their story. In my case, I was almost dead. So basically, you've got a story that's told by the victim, and it's got the mindset, the mental calculations. If there's any moral to it, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned just from watching. Observing what happens in a relationship like this and how it can be played out. Back then, sexual relationships were entered into quite haphazardly, and maybe that was a problem. There's also a subplot of my divorce case got fairly... ended in kind of sort of violence as well. And the whole book is kind of like the way I've built it before is Fatal Attraction meets Angela's Ashes to one extent, and then Kramer versus Kramer meets Fatal Attraction to another extent. My second wife got involved, played quite a role in it because Catherine was dead set at one point on having her dealt with, claiming that she could bring her thugs in to beat her up. And so she was involved to a certain extent. And then later on, I ended up with custody of my daughters before this was all over with when my ex-wife attempted suicide. And she called me and I came over and to where she was, and she'd taken some pills, and I got her in an ambulance, and she was taken away, and my two daughters at the time were 5 and I want to say 5 and 3 at the time. And so I ended up with them. That's how I quit working at the Houston Post at that point and became a freelance writer and did that for 17 years. Meanwhile, this happened after Catherine's conviction, but it's like the last chapter in my book, because all this happened over the course of a year from September of 1979 until September of 1980. I had all these things going on. So, and, you know, there's entertainment value too, I think. I didn't want to write basic slash and burn true crime. I mean, I enjoy the true crime genre, and I've been a fan of it. I've read lots of true crime, and I have, you know, some favorite books of true crime that I like. But this was a combination memoir, and it's a true crime story. So hopefully readers will take might take different things out of what they get from my story.
So do you have a website or anything set up for people to come visit you or see anything you're doing or done, or do you stay away from social media?
Like no, I'm fully I really don't fear anything. I have a public page on Facebook. I have a website. I also have a blog called I've been laughing all the way to the river. Part of my blog is, I've been retired since 2012, so I'm not really engaged in writing a lot anymore, except when I feel the urge, and that's what my blog is. My blog, I've tried transferring a lot of my magazine articles from when I was a freelancer in the 80s and 90s and lodged them there. It's a blog spot on Google Blogs, and I have other things that I blog about occasionally, but not too often. In retirement, I've done a lot of genealogical research, and I've written some of that up. I spend a lot of time with that. I went for years thinking I was poor white trash, and then I kicked over a genealogical rock and discovered I'm a Mayflower descendant. So, you know, I've reassured all my friends that I'm not going to let that go to my head. But there's that. The Amazon page, I try to make that a really solid backgrounder on the book. There's a lot of things there. A Q&A. I have a Q&A on my blog about that I did with another true crime interviewer a few years ago that goes through all of my thought process on doing the book. And I've also got that posted at the Amazon profile page for the book. I have another book as well that I did in 2010. It's another kind of true crime book about the closing of the notorious Chicken Ranch prostitution house in Texas that was made into the movie The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And that was a story all to itself about my getting hired to actually write the definitive version of that story back when the movie was going to come out with Dolly Parton and Burt Reynolds. The publisher went broke before they could publish the book, but so I hauled it out a couple of years ago and self-published it, and that's on Amazon as well. So I've got a profile page there, and the profile pages for the book are pretty documented.
Fantastic. Now we're going to have that up on our website. We'll put your book up there as well, so people can do one click when they're listening. The book is called Luggage by Kroger. It's a true crime memoir, and it's by author Gary Taylor. Thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot for having me.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.